Hi, I'm Patrick Palm, and this is the Learn from Leaders podcast. In this show, I interview favorite customers and other interesting leaders in product development, marketing, HR, executive management, investors. You find favorite leaders in many different places and in organizations doing game development and publishing, software as a service and other tech companies and big enterprises, you know, going from very centralized command and control kind of organizations to a more modern way of working with a culture with high team autonomy and better alignment towards the company goals and values. So let's go.
Tell me, what was the most important crossroads in your life or career?
That's a great question. The most important crossroads in my life or career, I think when I realized that I could do anything I put my mind to. I believe it was probably starting my own company, Beefy Media, after I had been in video games for about 12 years. I started my own company. And when you start your own company, you go on this journey by yourself. You know, if we think about life as a tight wire act, and you have that big net below you to create safety, when you start your own company, and I had a young daughter, she was 1 year old at the time, and a wife and a house, you realize that there is no netting below you. And when you fall, you can fall all the way to the ground. But what it gave me as a gift is it gave me the ability to think without repercussion, to think knowing that if you can survive that situation, you can survive anything. And that gave me the confidence and the power to be able to embark on a journey in my career and do things unabashedly, do things without fear, without regret. And so it was a fantastic gift I was given about midway through my career.
And I mean, you recently started a new company again, and I want to hear more about that. But does that mean that now is the second time you start your own company, or has it been, you know, more of those? Because, you know, you've also been at some of the really big players in the industry.
Yeah, it is my second. Yeah, it's officially my second company I've ever started. I guess I don't count the ones I did in high school, Patrick. I'd started three companies in high school. The first one folded. The second one, I abandoned. The third one, I got sued. So if I don't count those three before the age of 18, this is officially my second company. I was thinking that it gets easier each time. I think it's true because you understand the complexity and the challenges. But it doesn't make it easier, especially when this one's like 14 years later than the previous one. So I'm still learning as I go, still discovering new things every day.
So, I mean, when people start in your new companies, and especially starting companies with a big ambition, you know, like you've done, it is because there's an important problem to solve. There's an opportunity in the industry. And as an industry, you know, we've been going through some pretty dark times for a while. I definitely still feel that people are quite heads down, a bit of lack of optimism. So, you know, in short, I think it's fair to say that we're still in a bit of a crisis. Well, firstly, would you agree with that, or do you feel like it has really turned, with what you see from your horizon? And secondly, depending on if you agree with that statement or not, that we are in a crisis still, what is that great opportunity that you see, you know, in all of this?
Yeah, I do believe we're in a crisis right now. I think our industry is going through the hardest phase that I've seen in my 29 years that I've been in it. And that's actually was the inspiration for me starting my own company, was the fact that I spoke with so many industry leaders, so many executives and senior people in the games industry across developers, publishers, middleware companies, and just seeing this, that everyone was suffering through the same crises. And so when I started to ask them what they think pinpoint the issue, the massive challenges our industry is facing, I started receiving so many different answers. And even though I was working at Iron Galaxy Studios and, you know, running in and co-running a great team there, doing co-development for many of the biggest games in the industry, this sort of generic sadness and the crises sort of kept becoming just a topic of conversation. So that's, I started to explore what's our journey through. How do we actually create a map? How do we navigate through these challenging times? And that was the inspiration for my company Vibrato, which was, if I can actually build a navigable map to go through the different challenges that this industry is facing and then share those findings with the industry at large, then maybe we can start building a path of hope and resilience through these difficult and challenging times. And I know that sounds very sort of ambitious, but you're absolutely right that new companies sort of come out of organic exploration sometimes. Sometimes there's an idea that you have to explore. But for me, it was that revelation of all those conversations that caused me to sort of discover that there wasn't a lot of guidance and thought leadership in this world. And so I'd love to become part of that solution.
So before talking about solutions, let's go deep on the problems. I mean, what would be your kind of top list of, you know, what are, I mean, there's so many angles we can take on this. So you can really start wherever you want. But, you know, what would be your top list of the problems that we have today in the industry, which is, you know, holding us back?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's actually the wildest part about my exploratory journey, is that the more people I asked, the more different answers I got. And so I interviewed about 180 executives, and I got a list of 122. I got my 123rd the other day, which was a brand new one, which was actually the reproductive rate in the Western world. Meaning that if we elongate the timeline, then the player base is going to shrink because there is enough procreation occurring in Western countries, which was a fascinating new issue I hadn't thought about. If we really think about long term about the challenge of the industry. But I love the question, because every person that I spoke with had a different personal truth, or many of them I did. And so trying to find those themes and boil it down to, oh, what are the core three? What are the top five? What are the top even 10 was difficult coming up with that list, because everyone has their religion. Depending on where they sit in the industry and what they feel their issues are, their truth is it is problem X or Y or Z. You know, I think a lot of the larger themes were around discoverability, the amount of content to choose from these days, the price of building content, the way to attract users, user acquisition is a big theme. And then, of course, there's sort of macroeconomic issues. There's political, you know, aspects and issues. There's types of products from free to play to premium, games as a service, sort of taking a lot of people's time and effort, the attention economy. So those are many of the themes. We could definitely like grab one of them and unpack it, but it's very difficult, because I think a lot of times what happens is when people speak declaratively about the issue that they find the number one issue, they're actually speaking from their own lived experience. And that's why I think we need to sort of lay out the series of issues in front of us and then build a navigation path through each of these issues, or at least to put these issues out there in the open instead of saying it's this one singular thing.
So let's try to untangle it a bit. You know,
sure.
I already have a very long list of questions with a, you know, purpose of untangling. So I'll start with one. So
yeah.
You said that you interviewed a very large amount of executives, and
yeah.
And obviously, you know, through, you know, in your career, you know, you've been having, you know, access to that leadership, you know, level, and you know, you're also someone everyone knows, so that helps, you know. so you know, if there's someone who really have a good position to share a perspective on, you know, how do executives think about this? I mean, it is for sure you. And did you, so if I kind of do like a, let's say a horizontal and a vertical line here, where
sure.
If you think horizontally about executives, so did you find quite different answers if you compare executives that are at a big established publisher versus executives at a large but independent company, if you think executives at you know, a partner studio doing you know, co-development, you know, like Iron Galaxy, you know, comparing to a studio, you know, maybe VC funded, who is developing an original IP. So if you take that dimension, which is what I would here call, let's say, horizontal,
yeah.
And then maybe if you can also compare and contrast a bit with, if you had a chance to speak with people that are also a bit more junior, you know, the upcoming talent in the industry, you know, are they thinking very differently about what's our problem or our problems, or is there a, you know, a convergence there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you're absolutely right that sort of if we build archetypally across who I spoke with, you know, the closer they got to an executive role at a publicly traded company where there's shareholders and investors that, you know, are leading the charge or influencing the decision making, then absolutely cost management, revenue creation, you know, user acquisition, those were big themes. With mid and smaller, either studios or publishers, right? Discoverability, people finding the content, people building new and innovative products. Those are sort of some of the themes that evolve. And then you're absolutely right too. I didn't just speak with, you know, executives that in these only the big companies, but in the smaller companies and independent studios. Yeah, the problem set does change because then there's the, what I realized too is some of it is an echo of what they see on social media. So obviously the, you know, the layoffs, the instability right now in the workforce is a large concern for smaller companies and especially people that currently aren't employed. But that's sort of where you have to start as an, you know, analyzing the symptoms versus the root causes, tactics versus strategies. And that's where they do evolve sort of, like you said, horizontally and vertically. I think the convergence is just absolute fear, right? The fear of the unknown. The fact that it feels like the crystal ball is shattered, that the predictability of the industry is sort of gone. And, you know, because there's so many different factors that could influence, impact a product's life cycle and success. And so I think that is the one centrifugal force that emerged, was that everyone feels this uneasiness about the future.
So let's go a little bit deeper on discoverability.
Sure.
I've seen different numbers. One number I've seen is, you know, 7% of all the revenue in the industry is, you know, new, basically new games, and the rest is just spending more on existing games and franchises. But as I said, I've seen different numbers, but in common, all the numbers are very low. So it seems like we do have a pretty large, you know, problem with discoverability. It seems, you know, very risky to do something new. Do you feel like that's just the nature of things, or do you feel like this is because discoverability is a problem that isn't solved, that could be solved better, so this might change over time? Or if we just start a little bit on that end, I mean, do you know what is the natural gravitation, so to say, in the game industry for discoverability and success of you know, entirely new games?
Yeah, if we sort of unpack it over the last handful of decades, right? You go back to when we were kids and you'd pick up, you get the Sears, you know, toy book at around holiday time and look at what games are coming. And, you know, I grew up in a small town in Canada, so I remember when NES games are, I think, $89.99 Canadian, which was very high. But, you know, my discovery mechanism was my friends at school telling me what's cool, or this big toy catalog. And then as I got older, you start to see commercials, or you go to a game store and you see the posters on the wall. And so, but again, back then, there was sort of a finite amount of places where I find my information that drives towards my purchase intent. Then as I sort of get older and I graduate, and go into the workforce, then there's magazines like our EGM and IGN and stuff like that, that then become networks, online networks. And so my discoverability is like, oh, there's 8 websites and there's 5 magazines that show me where to go. And all the while, I think what was happening as social media started to emerge is a lot of other platforms, non-gaming platforms, started to really hone in on discoverability from early days of Google search, of sort of understanding people's intentions and tracking their nuances and needs. And I think now we're at a place where when we look at short form content, like whether we go to Instagram Reels or YouTube Shorts or TikTok, they do a phenomenal job of pushing us in directions to find things that they think we're going to like. And a lot of that was a trade-off of the amount of data that they're gathering about us. But in video games, I don't see the same progression. I don't see the innovation happening on platform stores as good as it is on other platforms where we can get stuff that we really want. Like if I could give up my friend network and no understand what they're playing And we have it on a per platform basis, but there's not really a holistic approach. So I think that's a big causality. But if we sort of go back to it, it's also because when we move from retail consumption, where we go into a store and there is a finite shelf space, there are X amount of, you know, shelves with Y amount of length that can fit Z amount of games. When we move into the digital world, there's infinite shelf space. The barriers to create content are lower than ever before. So anyone creates stuff, you know, how to get approved on platforms or how to get released is very easy. So we see the number of games releasing are going up. You know, it used to be, you know, maybe 1,000 a year many, many moons ago. And now it's, you know, 100 to plus or hundreds of thousands of games per year. So all of these things, I think, are pulling and tugging at our eyeballs. And then our attention is also being stolen by a myriad of different, you know, whether it's subscription TV or movies or short form content. So it's harder than ever before to attract those people. So I think it's an evolution on multiple fronts. How gamers play things, how we acquire content, how our attention gets hacked on a daily basis. All of those things, I think, are impacting how we draw people towards, you know, extremely engaging content for video games.
And I mean, how there's a bit of a connection, I guess, between this and financing, because if you're an investor and you're investing in a new studio doing something new, there's very low predictability and a lot of uncertainty around is anyone going to find this, even if it's actually a very, very good game. That creates a much bigger risk. What's your guesstimate, coming years on how will investors in the form of VCs, how will investors in form of, publishers? I mean, basically anyone who's financing the development and publishing of games, how do you think the landscape will change moving forward? Because if we're just stuck in exactly how it is today, it's a bit of a sad story.
Yeah, well, I think it's moving, and you use the great sort of comparison of horizontally and vertically, right? So the first thing is, in order to replicate success that occurred 2 years ago or 4 years ago or 6 years ago, it already adds a multitude and magnitude of challenges to even replicate or go after a successful story from before. But then the other challenging factor we have is how a venture capitalist or a private equity person or a traditional investor or a platform holder or a publisher, how they evaluate success is also different from group to group. Whereas a developer just wants money, usually, to make their game. So if you're a venture capital firm and you really want to see a return on an organization's output, right, a whole entire entity, not just the game concept itself, then you're measuring against certain criteria. Private equity is going to want, closer to mature products that they can sort of evaluate and make money as it goes. Publishers and platforms might have different KPIs as well. So when you measure all those things, the first challenge, I think, is developers aren't taking the time to evaluate the needs of the capital deployers very thoroughly. So you have the risk and the challenges that these investors and VCs have looking at the potential for a path to future success. Then you have the lack of understanding that developers have of how they measure, how these investors and VCs measure success. So you already have sort of a missed opportunity for deep collaboration and mutual understanding. Because as developer pitches from group A to group B to group C, their pitch doesn't change a lot, even though every single person they're pitching to, is looking for different things. So it adds a complexity where they're like, well, I'm going to maybe not deploy as much capital because there's multiple different risks. Not only is there a risk for the studio to understand how to go to market, publishers are evolving and changing week to week, month to month. And then on top of that, there's a lack of understanding between the two parties. So I understand why the sort of thawing of capital to deploy aggressively is occurring. But I think it's a matter of us sitting down as multiple groups to help build that path forward. That's kind of why the more and more I talk to these studios and these individuals and these entities and companies, is they're just sort of like shrugging and looking across the river, saying like it's kind of their fault that we're not moving forward. And in reality, we just need to get together, I think, and work through it as a group.
I mean, if we go a bit specifically on the on venture capital, I mean, how do you see that? You know, how do you see that that industry change? I mean, we've already been going in relatively short time from that. There was basically no VC firms specifically investing in new you know, game studios and related businesses. To that we have quite a few of them. To that we also have the more general VCs investing in games, and some of them are not doing that anymore. So there's already been a couple of phases we've gone through here in short time. How do you, you know, again, you know, if you're going to look at how you think things are going to progress, you know, the coming years, you know, is there kind of like a VC trend that you believe will unfold here in the coming years?
What I hope unfolds is patience and understanding, a deep sort of passion for understanding. I think what happens oftentimes is a trend emerges or a new technology stack, something that gets, you know, the industry or the tech world very excited, you know, increases the footprint of CES by 30%, and everyone sort of runs out to check out what the implementation can be, and whether it's, you know, over the years from, you know, mobile gaming to Facebook gaming to blockchain to AI and beyond. I think there's a lot of things that get people excited and fervent about what the future can hold. And I think what that evolves into oftentimes is investing in tool sets or investing in middleware or software as a service. I know some people sort of see middleware as an archaic phrase. And sometimes that is going to have the potential for a larger upside. I think some companies and some studios that sort of start to build their game studio because they have a game in their heart they want to make are fundamentally not aligned with working with a VC. And so I think it's important for the VCs to use that, to not get caught up in the hype cycle of, oh, these people made something really incredible, but instead they have a sound business, you know, plan and strategy. The more people I think that emerge from the operator position within the video games area in industry, so more people from developers, from publishers, and from platforms that move into venture capital, I think will create more of that sort of mutual understanding. Because I think if we go back 15, 20 years when it started, it was started nascently, it wasn't a lot of people that understood the marketplace. So what I'm hoping is that as we move forward and as we evolve as an industry, the more understanding we have between the different parties and the more cross collaboration we have and cross-pollinating between the groups, then hopefully the more capital does get deployed for the right reasons. I don't think people should just chase money just to chase money, just because they want to make their dream game. I think it does need to be mutually beneficial to both parties.
What's your take on transmedia?
I think it's super fascinating. I mean, I what I like to see is if we go back to in the olden days, the first time that I saw, you know, movies and comic book IP emerge in video games in a meaningful way, I think it was Chronicles of Riddick, right? Starbreeze made that successful game back in the day. And then we saw the Batman franchise with Rocksteady. And that was a neat way to see it, you know, us migrating from, you know, comic and TV and film into video games. And now we see the reverse is true. And the reverse can be serious and do well, from The Last of Us, you know, TV series on HBO to the Fallout series. Those are very impressive ways in which I think this our medium can move to the other parts of it. I think we finally nailed the part that when it's built by people, it kind of goes back to the question about VCs. The reason why it's more successful now is because the parties are understanding the intent and the context around what the visionaries are trying to deliver, right? Like Todd Howard being involved, you know, or Ed Boon being involved with the Mortal Kombat movie, or, you know, Neil Druckmann and his team at Naughty Dog being involved in The Last of Us show, is allowing the showrunners to truly understand the intent. So when done well, I think it's that 1 + 1 = 3. When done poorly, which we've seen over the years too, going all the way back to, you know, the E.T. game for Atari, when done poorly, I think transmedia can be an absolute disaster. So as long as it feels like an organic extension, I think that's a real important part of it. If it feels like an organic extension, if it plug and plays easily, if it makes sense, I think just ticking boxes and doing it just to do it, I think isn't as important. I also think people are less, brand. They don't have that sort of brand loyalty like they used to, but they do love the IPs that they want. You know, they're not going to stick with a whole publisher for all the things they do. They're going to stick with an IP that they love. And I think that's where transmedia can really sing when done well.
Do you think we will see more what maybe we can call, let's say, transmedia born products, where the intention from the beginning is to really go after, you know, a lot of different artistic expressions, you know, film, it's going to be a film, it's going to be a game, it's going to be a comic, it's going to be everything, you know? Or is it just too risky to pursue that?
I think it is risky. I think the having a goal from the start to be fully transmedia is kind of the comparison I use is it's like starting a game and saying you're going to build an e-sport. It's almost like you need one to become popular for the other part to work as well. So when you start too early with an audacious goal or too much of a scope, or I have a 5-game series I want to make, it's great to have those goals. But if I think you spend too much time and effort into that and making this massive sort of magnum opus proposal, then maybe it's the forest for the trees issue. If you make something that people love and then you expand from that, you know, if we go back to, you know, one of the great series that I've really enjoyed is Black Mirror. If Black Mirror at the start would have launched with a video game that was mediocre, but the show was great, then would I have cared as much about the whole package? I don't know. If there would have been a Squid Game in Call of Duty when the Squid Game first came out, would I have sort of looked at the TV series a little bit more with a sort of shrugged eyes versus what I look at it now? Potentially. So I think sometimes there can be an over-architecturing of transmedia experiences where it's like, I can't even get one started. It's hard enough to get a game greenlit than it is to get a game, a TV show, a podcast, and a Roblox experience all built at the same time. So I think there's going to be a room and place for it, and people that have that hunger and that thirst to build a multitudinal sort of product in transmedia IP, I think that's great. But I think there's a ton of risk involved. So as we see this contraction of the capital deployment, I think it's going to be harder for a studio to show up and be like, we have this $500 million franchise, we're ready, you know, we've never built anything before, versus someone that's like, hey, we built an IP 10 years ago, and then it started as a comic book, then we did a TV series, then we did a little game, and building it through time. So that way the players and the fans can go through that journey too. You know, it's very difficult to have anything become an overnight success. If we look at the history of Star Wars or any other large IP that we now currently are celebrating, it's because they've been around for 10, 20, 30, 40 years.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about talent and leadership. Let's start with talent. What's the difference between what made attractive talent coming into the industry, 10 years ago versus today? My question is basically, how do you think talent changes, in the industry?
I think the talent changes over time with the new skills that they sort of pick up. I think the biggest challenge that talent faces nowadays is that they have to almost, much like we were talking about awareness and attention hacking, they have to almost use the same methodology to get any attention when they're applying places, right? There's obviously more people than ever before that have been out of work in the games industry, which is a huge tragedy, which means that every single, job posting that has, way more applicants than ever before. So it's harder for an organization to really figure out who the superstars are or who the right cultural fits are. So I think it goes down to asking the right questions, getting very deep very quickly. I also think, back in the day, people hiring could be super picky. We can still do that today, but there are so many people that are talented and could do a good job. The other challenge is we've got this bifurcation where people are working with co-development studios as well. So it's not only that you're almost interviewing to start and work at a company, but you're almost going to become a salesperson or a collaborator with other companies. So having more talent that is focused on being part of a larger team, working well with others outside of an organization, you know, having to evolve from an individual contributor to a team manager or a collaborator or a cooperator, I think is critically important. So, and a lot of that, I think, having COVID occur and everyone having to go home and being remote, I think definitely slowed down that ability to collaborate. I think it's a lot more difficult, especially as young people starting in a job, to get feedback or ask for help when they're in a digital sort of remote space versus tapping someone on the shoulder. So I think there's a lot of challenges that the next generation of talent is facing. But, you know, I think it's still the industry needs to grow, needs to evolve. And especially with the adoption of brand new tools and technologies, the faster they get up to speed, oftentimes the younger people and newer talent are going to get up to speed very quickly on new tools and technologies, which I think is critically important, because bringing in that new energy, that new vibrancy, I think is really, really important for our industry to continue to evolve and thrive.
Taking what you said, I think I know you're going to answer to this question, but I do want to bring up the specialization versus being versatile. Historically in the industry, especially when it comes to artists, but I would say probably with everyone, it's been a very, very high degree of specialization, and some of that might have been imported also from the film industry. And you know what I'm seeing from my horizon, with production management, a lot of especially quite established studios has been around for a while. There's still a very, very high level of hyper specialization. But then you have VC backed startups where I find that people are a little bit more versatile in what they can do, and there are also examples of large studios that have more of that culture. I think a good example might be Larian Studios, where I was doing a podcast with Ben Kacic recently from the Building Better Games podcast, and we did a podcast around founder mode done right, and there was a few examples that he was taking there from Larian, and then he kind of brought up that even though there are it's a very big team, there's still that kind of culture of a bit of indie culture where an artist is expected to be quite versatile. So it seems like we have all variants of this. I'm guessing you're gonna say that we're moving towards more people being more versatile. Is that a correct guess, or what do you think?
I think in some walks of life, I think it really comes down to the culture of the company. As we move towards automation and the, even what AI is providing many people to be able to use tools and techniques that may be able to increase their efficiencies, I still think, the way that I think about it, Patrick, is that you can still go to a grocery store and you can buy a cocktail in a can and you can go home and crack it open and drink it. But we still go to the bar to have handcrafted cocktails made in front of us, right? We still go to restaurants and have these incredible chefs make their creations and give it to us when we could buy something from the corner store and put it in a microwave and eat it. And I think if we think about video games being an art form, I think we're always going to have specialization around people that want highly handcrafted experiences. Now, will AI ever be able to replicate a true human heart and soul? I can't look that far into the future, but I don't think so in the short term. So, but to the other side of it, I do think that people, especially when you say founder mode versus, a more mature company mode, we both know that the founder mode is just you're doing everything, right? I just got my new stickers for my company. I was pressing t-shirts, getting the website up and running. I've got some server issues with my mail server. There is no other players, right? I'm sort of bootstrapping this on my own. And so you have to try everything. I always like to work with people that are versatile. I think those are the best kind of problem solvers. But it also depends on what discipline you work in. Oftentimes I'm working in production, leadership, business development. And so you kind of have to be a chameleon. You have to be many things to many people. Especially when you get in a leadership role, I'm sure we'll touch on this later, but being a great leader isn't about having one methodology that works for everyone. It's about being a great individual manager for each of the human beings that you're working with. That's critically important. And so that's where that versatility comes in. If you're a one-stop shop and you do everything the exact same way, I think your ability to get the best out of a team and collaborate with multiple different teams from different walks of life is going to be challenged. But there is a time and place where people need to be able to be the best texture artist or the best VFX person, the best narrative designer that can sort of outperform anyone else in the industry. So I think there's always going to be room for both.
You did touch upon leadership. You know, let's go into that. So how do you think leadership is changing? And I mean, this is on so many levels. You know, we talk about, you know, team leadership, being able to lead the upcoming talent. That might not be exactly the same as it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago. More executive leadership. You know, how do you see leadership changing in the industry? Or maybe not changing and you know, that being a problem.
Yeah, I think the challenge I've seen through my career, and I think people feel this when I speak with people in different industries too, is that the vast majority of managers were not trained how to be great leaders. And what I mean by that is they were taught to manage a set of tasks or manage the output of a team or manage towards a finish line or, you know, a monthly delivery mechanism. And they weren't taught how to inspire. They weren't taught how to be vulnerable. They weren't taught how to be trustworthy, right? Oftentimes they misappropriate a manager role with ego and power, where they're in a position of authority. And so they can therefore impact others by telling them what to do and being sort of on a sort of a throne in front of a group of people. And that just is not the right approach. And I think that prevalence throughout our industry and many other industries is just the truth. And so oftentimes I think employees get frustrated, and then when they become managers, they either get to show them their way, and hopefully they've done training or research or have had enough good impressions and good people that they can follow in, versus just trying to replicate the power structure. So I think I wish there was more just honesty, vulnerability, trying to manage and work with the human condition and the not only the mental health challenges we have in the world, but trying to be a better just human being to other human beings around us. I think everyone would realize very quickly that you get far better results when you're genuine about that approach. But it just isn't the cool thing to do. It's cooler to brag on social media about the new car that you bought or your bank account. And that just isn't the truth. Of to be a good person and to be a well-respected leader, especially, is about ensuring that every person you come across is a little bit better when you left it, right? We have this saying in Canada, when you go camping, you know, and you want to leave the campsite better than you found it. And I think that's the same way that I approach building a team. You want to leave every single person you got to work with. First of all, you had the pleasure of working with them and meeting them, but you want to leave with them a little bit better than you did when you found them. And I think that's the best we can do as good leaders.
Maybe challenge is the wrong term, but just to give you a little bit of al dente on that. So,
sure.
Because we are in the creative industry, and one of the things that I think is incredibly fascinating with our industry is that you can have organizations where teams are very happy. There's a high level of autonomy. It's a high level of efficiency, but the game doesn't come out great. And it's a business failure. And on the other hand, you can have a team with a ton of anti-patterns. You can have a creative leader that in many ways are, you know, horrible, but then, you know, there's actually a really great game coming out in the end, you know, which is highly celebrated. And then they get a lot of money to make the next one. I guess my question is, in this industry, there's always that, let's say, extra dimension of creative excellence. Mm-hmm. How do you see, what's your approach to to that extra dimension that we have, because it does set the industry apart from other parts of the tech industry and basically, you know, most of it. So in many ways, you know, you could describe, you know, making a game is, you know, is as, you know, creatively challenging as making a movie. And on top of that, you have a ton of technology and programmers and everything to deal with as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a great question, because it does sort of expose the auteur driven creative process that does result in incredibly creative and transformative products. And I think the analogy used around Hollywood is a great one, right? Being on set with a Quentin Tarantino versus being on set with, you know, another type of director, you're going to get different results. There's different expectation set. I think part of that is in the culture of the company. If the team was built like that from the start, and I think that's a big problem the industry is trying to change or evolve. And sometimes I think maybe that change or evolution wasn't the right approach. If it was an auteur or vision driven company from the start, where it was work hard, play hard, you know, the expectations are very high, but the results are also very high. Transforming that company then, because it's the cool thing to do today, to be a more kind and understanding organization, might not be the right approach if you want the same results. So I do think there's different strokes for different folks, and people are attracted to different things. I think about my son playing hockey, or my daughter doing cheerleading, and having different types of leaders within those, you know, coaches that have different styles that they respond to differently. And sometimes it is the right thing to do to have that hard conversation, and sometimes it is to be the nice guy. I remember back when I was first in QA and I had my first management role, and there was another guy, we were both assistant QA leads, and I was more of the fun uncle and he was more of the sort of military dad. And at the end of the project, we pulled the team, and exactly 50% of the people loved my approach and 50% of the people loved his approach. And that goes down to sort of the human condition. Some people are drawn towards that sort of very stoic leader, where it's very sort of mission driven. And if everyone's incentivized correctly, and at the end of the journey, I think that's the important part. If there's sort of check-ins along the way and they're sort of re-giving their consent to be in that environment, and at the end then they're compensated commensurately with the experience that they went through, then it is a free market economy and people get to make their own decisions, right? So it all depends on what type of product you're making, what type of style of company you want to run, what the values of the company are, what the mission of the company is. And to your point also, like managing all the disciplines. Managing, and again, I don't want to put everyone in buckets, but historically speaking, in my experience, a group of engineers are different than managing a group of artists, that are different than managing a group of designers or a group of producers or a group of QA testers or a group of audio people. And so how do you then bifurcate that? Some of it is clarity in your mission, clarity in the deliverables, and then how you approach it. We still to this day in the industry have some teams that do more of the collective approach, where everyone has an opinion and everyone gets to be heard, and other teams that are run by it is from the top down, and you're going to implement that vision. And in the end, does the consumer or the player care? You know, as long as it's a great game, they really don't. But as long as, again, the path was an organic path for the group of people that understood what they were signing up for, I think that's fair game.
I mean, it actually goes also with tools. So I remember, you know, back when I built, you know, Hamsoft, you know, we were very popular with producers and with programmers, but we never really, you know, we were never really fully loved by the artists, you know, versus with Favro, we you know, we got the artists on, you know, on board. And so even, you know, like tool, you know, choices, it kind of shines through. It was interesting what you said there, and it reminds me about a roundtable at the DICE conference that I was moderating a couple of years ago, where we talked about autonomy, and the natural starting point of that whole conversation. And this was, you know, before COVID. Obviously, COVID really accelerated the need for, in a successful way, run. You know, teams and individuals in an autonomous way, because, you know, no one wants to be micromanaged over Zoom. But it was a thing already before that, simply because of, you know, efficiency and motivation and leadership. And there was so the natural starting point for that conversation was, you know, we talked about, you know, various agile practices and so forth. It was very much on a team level. But it was one person on the table who said something really interesting, because he had teams for his studio spread across quite different countries. And he brought up that the management style between these countries are quite different. There's a very strong natural gravitation that in how to manage things in you know, country A versus country B versus country C. So, and I thought he had a very good approach to this, because he said, well, I think about autonomy more on that kind of like studio level. So if they want to be, you know, super micromanaging, you know, using a, you know, freaking Gantt chart in one of those studios, that's fine. You know, I put my, you know, the goals and objectives and the direction, basically, it happens like one level above. And then you have the other team, you know, in that other country, where the culture is much more, you know, collaborative, and they want to work in a different way. You know, that's fine too. So he was just lifting that autonomy like one more level. So he was like, you know, this is an incredibly, you know, this company, you know, we have a very high level autonomy on the teams, but what that autonomy looks like in execution of things was actually very, very different. And I thought that was interesting, and I think it resonates a bit with what you just said there.
Yeah, absolutely. And with Iron Galaxy Studios, at any one time, you know, we're working on 15 different projects with different creators, you know, from Blizzard to Naughty Dog to Microsoft to Bethesda to Nintendo. And so you have to conform to their processes and procedures, but you still, like, there's multiple cultures within and work processes within the larger organization, the large company, and then within your team working with that partner. And then even within each discipline. So you're almost playing like the multi-culture, multi-value, multi-chameleon game, where you have to conform to their practices. And that's where that resilience comes through. As long as the goals are set and the clarity in how you approach things and how you achieve your goals is set, I think that's critically important. It really resonates with me. I moved to Dublin early in my career and had managed a team of people with 15 different ethnicities around the world. And you're absolutely right that each group responds to things differently. And we find that too with partners and publishers, especially if they're overseas in different regions. You almost have to sort of do the first month or two is understanding the cultural differences and then conforming to them. But I think it teaches a lot of people about resilience and walking in other people's shoes. I think sometimes if we're too prescriptive in our approach, if something worked at our last company for 10 years, we oftentimes walk into a new role and we're like, well, I did this in my last company this way, and this works for us. It's like, well, it worked for you during that season when the temperatures were right and the humidity was different and you guys were eating different types of food and you could make the sourdough that tasted the way that it tasted, versus every new team has different experiences. And how do you take something that works, but then add in the layers of the localized aspects of it to make it work for a team and get motivated, aside from being prescriptive and anointed from on high that you must follow this process.
So on the topic of diversity, I have a hot topic for you here then.
Sure.
So so when it comes to initiatives around, you know, DEI, you know, the games industry has been very strong on that, I would argue, compared to many other industries. When being at the games conference, the voice is very often that, you know, we're really bad at this and we need to do more. That might be true, but again, compared to other industries, it's been, you know, something very strong in the games industry. Now, if we look at tech more in general, it has been strong in Silicon Valley and rest of tech world. But there's been a lot of change there, you know, recently, and it got a very, very political dimension now also. Do you see that some of that kind of pendulum swinging the other way that we've seen in tech? Is that, do you think that will happen in games as well, or do you think that the game industry will kind of basically continue on the path that it is right now?
I think the reality of it is that every company is going to go on their own journey to find out what works best for them. It goes back to us sort of bifurcating, you know, the entire industry as a whole versus each individual company and their values and what missions and values and goals mean to them. You know, the analogy that I used early on when I was explaining to friends of mine back home in Canada about what it means to me. You know, we grew up in British Columbia, right outside of Vancouver. And growing up, we really sort of ate two types of fish when we went fishing, right? We would eat salmon, sockeye salmon from the rivers, or we would have trout from the lakes. Sometimes we would have some nice Pacific salmon. We would have Dungeness crab, usually from like Washington State. And so we sort of ate those four products from the sea and the lakes and the rivers. And so when you go into, imagine if you walked into the fish section of your store and it only had those four things. And so why don't we bring in different things to allow people to try different aspects and perspectives so we're not all living off of the same intent? And oftentimes when a studio gets built somewhere in a place where they knew a bunch of people, they just bring in the people that they know and those people bring in the people that they know. And I think you oftentimes get stuck in the groupthink or the echo chamber. So I think the intention around bringing in a multitude of people from a vast different backgrounds and experiences to build something that should have, you know, in many cases, people want to have global admiration, right? From people all around the world. So, you know, the more diverse ideas that are coming into that creative endeavor, you know, if that's the goal set that you're trying to set, I think is can be a great outcome. Now, I think where the politics get a little bit, you know, challenging is the mandating of it and the politicization of it. I think that stuff is, you know, we can look to social media to see how we can ever have really meaningful conversations around any of it, which we can't, because I think we've outlawed having gray area conversations about any of these sort of topics. So I think it's going to be up in the future. It's going to be up to the companies themselves to do what's right for them, for what's right for their products. But I think sometimes it's sad when we lose the forest for the trees, if the intention was, let's get a bunch of different minded people together to build things that we think are very special for a broader subset of players, then that intention, there is no bad intention in that approach. I think the approach sort of starts to get, you know, people start to deride it or put labels on it when it doesn't fit their narrative. And I think that's the challenge of any change in our industry.
You know, I have a draft script on my phone for a small video I will make that I'm going to call "Make DI Great Again." we'll see how it comes out. All right, so you touched a bit upon this before when we were talking about some of the effects that you know, COVID had, and I'm gonna get straight to the point of something I think is quite interesting right now in really any industry, but I think it's highly important and it has massive consequences how we handle it, and that is a bit around hybrid work. This touches upon, I think, both, you know, talent and, you know the versatility we talked about. You know, you brought up that you know, the collaboration aspects got harder when people were working from home. And one of the points that I've been making in a lot of different everything from you know, fireside chats and panels to one-on-one conversations is that you really have to make up your mind and you really have to design your organization for the way you want it to operate. So if you are going to operate as remote first or hybrid, you know, you need to have the leadership, you know, team structure, you know, the right tools, you know, to really support that. And that can be working absolutely amazing. I did one of our customers, Spectarian Games, a VC funded exciting studio. They were, you know, born remote first. So I had a good podcast, you know, with them around, like, you know, when you were born that way, you know, how does that affect how you do things? And then I've seen, you know, typically when I see companies and you know, studios specifically here struggle with this is when you really had that office culture, but then you were forced to work in more of a remote way or hybrid way, and it just never really fit because it was always that you did, you know, it was like second choice in how you did things, you know?
Yeah.
What I think is really interesting now that I would love to hear your take on is that I think in our industry, like we have seen in other industries, there are these return to office mandates going on. And in some cases, it is like 100% return to office. It really back to like how things used to be. But in most of the cases, what I'm observing is that it's actually not 100% return. So they say, okay, we have a return to office mandate. But then they say, and this means 3 days per week, you need to be in the office. So that's still 2 days, where it will be remote. And my big, question, around this is that I think a lot of companies are really messing this up because that's, almost half of your time that you're going to be hybrid. So you still need to optimize for working a hybrid way, because otherwise you're really only going to get, half out of the team than you potentially could. So it's always going to be, a little bit awkward, so to say, in how you work together, because, it's not really, set up for that. And I think, something that happened already before COVID that adds to this is that companies that are a little bit bigger, they are in practice, team of teams, and people might be geographically spread anyways. So you're really working kind of a network anyways. So even if you're in an office at your company, you're still collaborating with people that are not sitting next to you. So it's kind of hybrid anyways. So that's like me setting the stage a little bit for this topic. I have a strong sense a lot of companies are like really messing this up right now. What's your take on this?
It's a great topic. I think part of it is, I think what we're going to see over the next 5 and 10 years, we're going to see successful companies that are all remote. We're going to see successful companies that are hybrid. We're going to see successful companies that are, all in person. We're also going to see failures in all three of those categories as well. So I think it's difficult for me to say a proclamation that if you are doing thing A, thing B, thing C, it's kind of like me saying you should like Italian food better than you like Indian food. And I'm not in the position to say that, because every team goes back to intent. We talked about tour-driven stuff. We talked about choosing whether DEI is important to you and your team. A lot of these decisions are going to be personal to an organization or a team. And like you said, if the DNA, if the core sort of design of something was remote from the start and that's how it worked, I think the biggest companies that are facing challenges are ones where it was in person at the start, and then COVID, they transitioned to remote, and now they are doing some sort of hybrid approach where they have not landed the clarity of what's expected on all different fronts. From my personal experience, I think there's certain areas where, hybrid can work well, where if you're coming in for larger gatherings, you're still getting the feeling of the larger group. I think when it's coordinated across what days you're in together, and those are times that you're sort of collaborating with your team members and you're interacting. I can understand people's perspectives that they don't want to be forced to do something. I think it's also discipline led. There's some disciplines that don't make as much sense to be part of a team. If you're a solo accountant in a game studio and you're not interacting with people on a regular basis or popping into people's offices for conversations, right? Maybe that might make sense for you. The challenge when it gets to running a larger organization is you have to create a policy that's fair and balanced, that is sort of free of bias. And that's, I think, when you get in this sort of sticky situation where, you definitely can't have a hybrid policy where everyone's in 4 days a week except for the CEO, who's only in 1 day a week, because then you're sort of setting the bad expectations. So as long as everyone understands what is expected of them, if it's working for the culture of the company, then I think it becomes very difficult for me as an outsider to come in and say, hey, you should do more of this or more of that. Because ultimately, it's about, there's not only the productivity side of it, there's the enforcement side of it. Are you going to, do fob key recognition? Are you doing check-ins? Are we doing IP checks? So, how much more of a militant state do you want to create within your organization versus is it number of check-ins that you're measuring? Is it productivity? Do we check how long you're in, you're online or you're offline? So I think the measurement starts to sort of miss the point. The point being is that if you have an organization where you can't measure or have a feeling of progress from a team of people, whether they're in person or remote, that's the fundamental true problem. And so any decisions you're making should really be about ensuring the efficiencies of the company and the results. And if you're customer driven, ensuring that the customers are happy or the players are happy, and so on and so forth. So I think I have a really hard time being declarative I have my own feelings. You know, I'm building a new company. I want eventually to get office space. It will probably be most of the time in person because we're working with a lot, but we're also doing a lot of work with a bunch of different clients in different areas. So it can be more of that sort of hybrid approach. And I'm very confident that we'll get to a nice happy medium. But every company's a bit different. So I'd love to hear your perspective on sort of from all the conversations you've had. You know, it sounds like you have opinions about people implementing hybrid poorly. What are the areas that you think that they're missing? Is it that they're not declaring sort of the expectations evenly, or what are the areas you think where the failure points have been?
Oh, wow. That's a long list. So if I start with the talent thing, one of the great benefits of running a company in a remote first or hybrid way is that you will have access to talent that you might not have otherwise. You know, there's quite a lot of people that for personal reasons wants to live in a certain place and maybe not move to the place where you have an office or you know they're simply not there. So now you have this chance to, you know, give them a career where they will work on something really, really exciting. And it doesn't matter that they are, you know, they are geographically in a place which is, you know, not where you have your hub. Now, understanding that, you know, that is a great upside to a remote first approach, I think is quite intuitive for most. The problem and where this gets messed up is that if you start getting into a situation where it is more valid to be the person who's in the office all the time and these other people are seen as kind of satellites and you're not really part or core, you know, then you basically end up with that culture that the ones that are a bit more remote, you know, they are not as kind of core in the team as the ones that are in the office. You're going to start alienating that talent, and then you don't get that benefit. So it's basically a way to ruin that benefit. So one of the things you kind of hinted at that I think works really well, we do this ourselves at Favor as well, is that on a regular basis, this can be kind of like whole company or it can be more on a team basis, you have your get-togethers. And you have your get-togethers when it is most you know, suitable or needed to have get together. So that might be that, you know, you have, you know, let's say, you know, more of some planning days where you're going to have, you know, wild discussions about priorities and you know, what excellence looks like, et cetera, et cetera. And those kind of, you know, animated conversations might be best to have, you know, face to face. And that's a good time to get together. But then, you know, then you get into more, let's say, you know, delivery mode. And then you're kind of going back to, you know, people go back to wherever they are. So that's one approach that works really well. And it doesn't have to be that the whole company comes together at the same time. You know, it's very nice if you can do that once in a while. But this can be also a bit more autonomous. It's more, let's say, a team basis. So having that kind of cadence where, you know, you do meet from time to time, but then in between, you know, it's remote. So that's a practice that works quite well with that. The other thing is very much around you know, autonomy. So if you have autonomy without alignment, it's going to be chaos. So. Mm-hmm. But this is where I think, especially in the game industry, where it often goes wrong, and that is that a lot of managers, the only way they know how to create alignment is through micromanagement. Mm. So they're just trying to like micromanage. You know, it might be that they don't even understand that that's what they're doing. You know, they're creating like you know piles of tickets in Jira or something like that, and they are basically like, you know, managing all of that, and they everything gets broken down into molecules and everyone is their own island, and then, you know, they're trying to micromanage that. And that's for many people quite demotivating, but it's also not very efficient. Then the question is, of course, you know, what's the alternative? And you know, here I can go on forever. But I think you actually hinted at it yourself. You were saying that you need to make sure that you measure the right things, and what you really want to measure is throughput. So instead of measuring, you know, like, you know, how many check-ins did you do, or how much time did you spend in the office, or how much time did you spend on your keyboard, are you really measuring, you know, how much work is actually getting through? And you know, of course, here, you know, your choice of tools comes in, you know, with something like Favre, very much designed from a much more flow-based approach. But, you know, we don't have to bring tools into this conversation. It's really more of a leadership thing where I think, I can't remember who said it. It was, you know, Mary Poppendick or someone else, but it was like, you know, as a manager, don't manage tasks, manage flows. You know, leave the task execution to the person who's doing the job. What you want to look at as a manager is the flow. It's like, you know, how are things flowing through? You know, where are the bottlenecks? How can I help removing the bottlenecks and actually measuring that? And one of the cool things about this is, you know, I did a whole podcast around estimation, also with Ben Kacic, which is that what a lot of producers are doing still, even though it's 2025, is that they break things down into molecules. And again, this tend to go a little bit hand in hand with using traditional tools like Jira. And then you have everyone putting in their hourly estimates, and then you aggregate up and you come up with a very specific number, and then you're happy and you think, okay, cool, I have this specific number, I know how many people I have or I'm going to hire, and now I know, you know, what I'm going to deliver and what milestone. And it works horribly bad. And we've been doing this forever, and it never worked well, and still doesn't work well. So then, again, you know, the answer is, the question is, well, what's the alternative? And the alternative is throughput metrics. And the thing with throughput metrics, when you're measuring basically like, well, you know, like typically how long does it take to get a feature, an asset, you know, through, you know, our workflow. And you use that measure, and that's not going to be as specific. And that is typically what scares people. They're like, well, this is not a super specific measure, because if I look at this at the last 10 weeks, you know, that's a pretty scattered chart. If you look at the control chart in for example, Favro, you will see that, okay, that's a scattered chart. This can't be correct. But the nice thing, you know, the science actually is that even if this is a somewhat scattered chart, the accuracy is amazing. So you get a super high predictability on actually how you're going to deliver on a certain milestone. So, you know, I can go on long about this, but this is, if you don't even know that you should measure throughput, as you were suggesting, I mean, then you don't even have a good start. So step number one is knowing, okay, I probably would like to look at throughput, because then I'm not micromanaging these teams and these people that needs to be, you know, more autonomous, because I'm not going to be like looking over the shoulder, you know, constantly. And then you can start, you know, when you realize that, you can start thinking about like, well, okay, cool. Well, how do I do this in a good way? And then we can go into details on some of the things I just mentioned. So those would be, you know, some of the key things that I think organizations are really messing up today.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, which is it's about the context, right? And the alignment. And I love that the whole theme of autonomy, because I think you also sort of, we touched on this earlier, is that if you have autonomy, but there are no constraints, then that leads to absolute chaos.
Yeah. So, and that's sometimes what happens with some VC-backed companies is that, you know, they're like, okay, you know, we want to be modern in our leadership. And we don't want to be old school. You know, we want to get, you know, the best new talent. You know, we want everyone to be happy. We want a super high level of autonomy. Okay, that's great. And then, you know, you raised a lot of venture capital. So you're kind of getting away with everyone, like, you know, running in different directions for quite a while. I've seen so many, I'm not going to mention any by name here, but I've seen a lot of students absolutely crash and burn. You know, they raised a lot of money. And they got amazing talent, and it absolutely crushed and burns because they had
WeWork.
Had the
Let's
money.
Just say WeWork, Patrick. The WeWork, the video game WeWork.
Well, that's yeah, but you know, I'm also, you know, in the games industry, there's some really good examples too. But so the thing which is missing there is that alignment. There's another really good saying, which is that alignment enables autonomy. You know, if you have and this is also something which is really hard and many leaders are simply not that good at, and that is that, you know, they think, you know, autonomy and alignment is a choice. No, it's not a choice. It's like a skill, both on an individual and on a team level. It takes a while to build up alignment in a company. Mm-hmm. And also on different levels. I mean, if you have someone who's a very junior person in the beginning, they can probably not have too much autonomy because they are still very much learning the basics. You have the concept in martial arts of shuhari, where the first step is that you basically imitate, and the next step is that you understand kind of like the rules, so you can operate autonomously. And then the third step, is that now you can innovate and take things. That's kind of like when the student becomes master.
Yeah.
So you have that when you build up teams as well. So a highly a creatively aligned and of course also production wise aligned team that are operating with a high level of autonomy, that is not something that's born overnight. It's a lot of talent and work to build that up, but if you successfully build it up, it will give you amazing results, both in terms of creativity and productivity. So it's worth the effort, because if you get it right, you're going to be better than most others.
Yeah.
So, on this topic, I do want to ask you something on production as well, because you have a bit of background there, so it would be great to get your perspective. So, I was doing a live fireside chat, basically like a live version of this podcast, on stage at Nordic Game last year, the Nordic Game Conference, and one of the things that came up there was. Basically, a little bit around production practices. I'm obviously a bit biased in this topic, since Favre is designed to support more modern practices, but again, we don't really need to go into tools for this to be an interesting topic. And that is the thing that was coming up was that we have been standing a little bit still when it comes to production practices. I brought this question up by saying that when I started going to conferences in the games industry 20 years ago and doing a lot of talks 15 years ago, we're kind of still talking about the same things. It feels like we haven't really moved that far. It's like it's the same problems when it comes to production management then as now, and I'm a little bit sad that when I look at other tech companies in other industries, if I look at SaaS companies or fintech companies, etc., it feels like they have moved forward much better. There's a much higher level of maturity when it comes to development methods and practices and so forth, and things like embedded QA and automated testing and how you do release management and level of agility with the teams to be able to adapt to things being constantly chaotic and you have to adapt fast, etc. So there's a lot of these things that companies have become pretty good at, and we've been standing pretty still in the games industry. So we're all agreeing that was the case, and I would love to hear if you agree. But my real question here is, if you agree, why is that? Why are we actually standing still on when it comes to moving forward when it comes to production practices?
I love this topic. It's so funny as you're speaking, I'm thinking about, we are, ironically, even though we're on the cutting edge of interactive entertainment and human beings like having great experiences, we're managing it more like a factory. Like we're closer to the auto industry than we are to the tech industry. And why is that? So as you were speaking, I thought a lot about, I think part of it is the people that are usually promoted, right? Historically, I mean, early in my career, the people that were promoted were the people that were the ex-producers. And so they made things the way they made things. And if you deviate from a plan, especially if we look at the most successful franchises that have been around for 20 plus years, largely they probably haven't adopted or adapted because they haven't had to. And so when those people then get promoted or moved to new companies, they're like, well, we just got to copy the same way in which we got to make the 4.150, because we got to make that over again. Versus, and I think where we've seen the biggest innovation have been the new school companies that build from nowhere or are on the innovative side of publishing. Because you're right, I got promoted out of production just as Waterfall was becoming not cool anymore and people were migrating to Agile. And I remember sitting down on a project when I was running the department and they're like, oh, we're going to pivot to Agile. I'm like, what is this? Witchcraft. What is this shenanigans? Back in my day, we did it this way and that way. And so I think a lot of it is about fear, right? Our fear of breaking the mold, our fear as an industry of being too innovative. And I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier about discovery. The reason why we aren't as good as other industries is because I think people are just like used to the status quo. And I don't think it's the right approach. I think it's driven from fear and the unknown and many of the topics that sort of are overarchingly we've touched on during this chat. And so it's difficult to change someone's mind, right? In my experience too, I mean, we look at all the emerging tools and technologies. Until I started my new company, you know, a handful of months ago, I hadn't dug into them. From the podcast software Riverside.fm we're using to, you know, playing around with different AI models and stuff like that. If I didn't need to play around with it, or if I didn't need to change, then why am I looking at new frontiers? And I think that's what we find is people get stuck in their ways and then they get promoted and then there's no real incentive to change. So I'm assuming, and I'd love to ask this question back to you, the people that are the most passionate about Favreau, are they the people that are more in the sort of mid-level positions or that are sort of the younger set generation? Or you're finding it's a top-down decision. Where do you usually find your customers sort of coming from?
That's quite easy to answer, actually. It is typically either, you know, very much on the top. You know, most CEOs in the world, you know, they're there because they're typically pretty smart. And yeah. it's normally not that hard of a pitch for me to say that, you know, the tools you're picking will have an effect on the culture you're building. So if you are having a strategic initiative around that, you want your company to be, you know, more flat, you know, less middle management, you want to have a higher level of autonomy, you want, you know, managers that are more like kind of servant leaders than micromanagers, you know, all of that stuff. I mean, none of this is controversial. It's really 101, you know, leadership 2025. So most CEOs will be like, okay, you know, this is where we want to go. We want to be better at this. And if I then put forward to them and say that, you know, the tools you're picking, it's the same as, you know, back when maybe, you know, how your office looked was the most important thing. The tools you're picking are really going to be important for your culture. So if you're trying all these things, and I'm going to be specific about competitors here, but then, you know, your IT department says that, well, we're going to use Jira because that's what we always used. I mean, that's going to create a gravity towards the old.
Yeah.
You know, so if you want something which is not biased towards micromanagement and centralization, then you do need to pick something which is the opposite. An interesting parallel that I often do is that there's a totally different part of the tools industry that already been going through this, and that is marketing tech. So far back, it used to be that, you know, tools that had to do with marketing, that was an IT decision. But that decision moved to becoming owned by the chief marketing officer, or if you call it chief growth officer, which is a common title today. Often it might actually be that the CMO has a bigger tools budget than the head of IT actually. And this is, you know, totally accepted today. No one would challenge this today, but it wasn't always like this. So it's the same thing here. It's like, okay, you care about your organization, you care about your culture, and, you know, every CEO know the Michael Porter quote that, you know, culture eats strategy, you know any day, or if it's for breakfast, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Anyways, culture eats strategy. So everyone knows that. Everyone knows that quote. So with CEOs, you know, that level is typically not a hard sell. And bottom up is typically not a hard sell either, because that talent tends to be more junior. You know, they're full of energy of doing things better. So the big problem is typically mid management. It is, you know, those producers that, you know, they were on a big production before. And I think it's exactly what you said. I think it's fair. So they were on this big production before. You know, that is what led them to getting this job and this position, which is, you know, probably a promotion. And they don't want to rock the boat. You know, I know how I did it on my previous productions, so I'm going to do it the same way now. I think that, you know, when I did that fireside chat at Nordic Game, you know, one of the answers that I think fits into what we're saying now is that, well, it takes, you know, like a really big production, it takes a few years to do. So you can have a person who's quite a senior producer in title and in years, but they actually not made that many products.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a bit different from in tech, you know, where, you know, maybe you're releasing every day or every week or so, building a SaaS company. And you're just like, well, we've done, you know, 100 iterations of this, and we have ripped out and we just changed so much, so many times, that it's just so much more continuous development. So it's a little bit of that kind of more boxed product thinking that we, right, you know, more literally had before in the game industry. The thing that surprises me though with Fear is that the biggest cost you have, you know that's your team. You know, it's if you look at, you know, what's the difference between a very, very efficient team and a not so efficient team, it's just so much money. And if you look at risks, it doesn't matter if you're a publisher and you're asking, well, you know, when we are doing our, you know, closed alpha, you know, what's going to be in that closed alpha? You know, what's that going to look like? You know, what, or if you're a VC, you know, asking this new company that you invested in, it's like, well, you know, how much money do you need to get to closed alpha? You know, if those estimates are very off, it's really not good. Yeah. You know, there are some teams, we all know who they are, that can basically say it's done when it's done. But for most of us, we don't have that luxury. You know, it's like if we need to tell our VC or our publisher, like, well, we're going to need another year. And that's a lot of money. It's like that's not a very acceptable answer. So I'm a little bit surprised that that's not a bigger thing, that you know higher up executives aren't more forceful, actually, like, well, we can't keep going like this. We can't just accept that this is what it is and it's too hard, because it's not true. Because there are, and I mean, you know, you were asking like who's buying Favro. Well, we do have customer, typically, you know, the VC backed ones that, you know, from day one, they were using throughput-based metrics. They don't have any programmer putting in any estimates. They are simply just looking at their control chart in Favro, like, well, how long does it take typically to make a feature? How long does it take typically to make an asset? You know, maybe an asset of a certain type. And then they do the estimates based upon that, and it's very accurate, and they actually hit their milestones. So you know, it is possible. And then, you know, for the one who doesn't believe this, I mean, you can look at other industries. You know, there are other industries that are actually pretty good at this. So, To wrap up my comment there, I think it's not so strange that when we see a more established studio contacting us saying, like, hey, you know, we're interested in, you know, in getting you know, your platform, you know, Favro, and I had a good case recently where it was like, you know, two production teams moving from Jira to Favro, their publishing team moving from Asana to Favro, and their management team using from Monday to Favro. But the person who was driving that was coming from outside of the industry. You know, that person was basically hired by the studio to disrupt themselves. It's like the studio had realized, okay, we really need to disrupt ourselves. You know, we can't keep going like this. We're going to be out of business soon. We really, really need to change how we work. And as part of that whole initiative, they hired a new head of production that actually came from another industry. The person did have a game development experience, so, you know, he wasn't clueless about it, but he was definitely bringing in, you know, practices from, like, okay, well, this is actually how you can do, for example, you know, development, you know, method, you know, how it's done in more of a tech industry.
I think you're hitting on basically it's the human condition that we're sort of exposing as the challenge, because producers, right, if we sort of use the allegory that they're like sheriffs and their town is the project, right? And so they want to track all the people that are in jail, the tasks that need to be done, and they know exactly what cell they're in and when they're moving from cell A to cell B. But we know as an industry that is not the most optimal way, but they know that's how they can control things, and they know they can understand things, even though other ways are more efficient. And so it's almost like we're prioritizing as an industry still the you know, the tracker methodology of that old sheriff's department versus a new school way to adopt thinking, where it might make that producer feel uneasy, but the end result is going to be a more productive team, which saves products more money and is able to explore innovation faster. And I think maybe do you think that's sort of part of the issue?
Yeah. And it makes me actually think about a book tip.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So one book that inspired me a lot, you know, when we were originally designing Favro, was a book called The Art of Action by Stephen Bungie. You know, he's a former BC Boston Consulting Group consultant, but more importantly, he's a military historian. And in this book, the word agile, I don't think, is used a single time. And the very short summary of the book is that he says that we have a very old problem that also has a very old solution. And the problem is basically, how do we handle running a business when everything just changes so fast? And this is, of course, very, very applicable to anyone, you know, running a a live game. So, you know, any kind of like, you know, live ops, you know, situation where everything is changing and you have a very, very high level of iteration. And I think as most senior leaders know, the power of your company, the power of your organization is really about how fast can you iterate, you know, as a company. And the whole company needs to iterate fast. It's not enough that just a product team is like, you know, has super high agility and they iterate very fast. You know, you need your marketing team to iterate, you know, in sync with your product team, and your community management to iterate in sync with them. And then, of course, you know, you don't want your senior management to be totally out of the loop. You want them to also iterate. So it's not about a single team. You know, the whole machine, so to say, needs to be iterating fast. And anyways, so what he's talking about, he's saying that, you know, this whole problem has happened once before in war. And I'm not going to give away the whole book, but he starts by talking about the battle of Jena, where Napoleon absolutely crushed the Prussian army. And the Prussian army used to be, they had a reputation to be the absolutely best army, but they were very reliant upon basically kind of like centralization and micromanagement to simplify it a little bit. And it broke down, you know, because that day was so chaotic on the battlefield. It was like fog and it was just very chaotic for many reasons. And Napoleon's kind of like ragtag army there, they were not as, you know, disciplined or well-trained or anything. But the one thing they had was that since they were this ragtag army that he had kind of pulled together, each team was very, very autonomous. So they were operating in that way. And basically, well, then, the Prussians kind of like stole that tactic. And this is how they won at Waterloo. And then he kind of continues to say that, well, this is basically, you know, what is, you know, a mission command within NATO today, which is, you know, very efficient. So he's basically making the point in this book that, you know, the military can like run into this problem of like very, very high level of chaos that you need to handle once before. And business life in today's world have run into the same problem. And it's really just the same solution. Like how do you have a very high level of autonomy with alignment that does not build upon centralization and micromanagement. So, it's a really, really good read for anyone who wants to go a little bit more philosophical and strategic about these topics.
That's cool.
Finally, I am. We can't have this conversation around talking a little bit more about AI. So, since I've been dabbling a little bit with film as well, so not only, you know, I'm doing favor, but I'm also doing some game investments and I've been doing some film investment as well. And the film industry is dead scared of everything happening with AI. And my impression is that there's a little bit less fear and a little bit more optimism within the games industry, but also still a lot of fear. And I think it's very interesting everything which is happening. Is, you know, we both have things happening more on the content side of things, but also when it comes to more orchestration on the gameplay side of things, I think there's also very interesting things happening. What's your, you know, because I'm guessing that with, you know, your clients with your new, business, you know, one question that would probably come up quite often is like, well, how is, you know, what kind of take shall we have on AI, you know, in with our studio or with our publisher?
Yeah, I love the topic. It's a complicated sort of landscape because AI right now means so many different things to so many different people, right? You talk about Gen AI, you talk about AI tool sets, you talk about LLMs. I mean, there's a bunch of different ways. And I think many people in the games industry specifically tend to have an opinion on something if they feel like it's going to endanger the art form or the employment status of people. And I understand that concern. That's absolutely sort of a righteous concern. When you dig into the sort of all the different tools and technologies and potential applications of AI, I think there's a lot of really fascinating places in which it could make a ton of sense, right? For helping people build things faster, iterate faster, not replacing human beings per se, but there's ways in which, for example, I can dictate and build a presentation to ChatGPT as we're chatting, or I can talk to Claude when I'm by myself and sort of work on problems together. And that just helps my creative juices and my energy flow in the right direction so I can build stuff. I can just think about different visual storytelling aspects and use Midjourney to help push me along the way or tell a better story quickly, right? These are not things that I would ever hire a co-writer to do. These are not things I would ever hire an artist to draw. So there's a lot of ways in which I think we can adapt it into our lives right now. I think the most important part of it as an industry is we need to get very clear on what threat it poses to a different areas of our industry, right? If it poses a threat to music creation or musicians' jobs, or if it poses a threat to voice actors' jobs, or if it poses a threat to, you know, people that are doing concept art or creating art themselves and stuff like that. I think there's a lot of different things that we need to almost designate. I've been throwing around this idea of like, if we create a kind of like, you know, when you go to buy some produce and it's got the organic label on it, how do we create the you know, sustainable AI that won't affect, you know, people's livelihoods? I think, you know, trying to create some designation in the industry for us to explore it in a more open-minded manner, because it's not going to go anywhere. We definitely, I think, should put in checks and balances for how it can sort of infiltrate or challenge our industry. But on the receiving end of things, there's going to be a point in which players are okay with the repercussions or the lower quality or this or that. And so whose job is it to regulate or approve or deny when it's used and how it's used versus it being finally just the decision of the end player or the consumer at the end? So that's a big question I think a lot of people have been exploring, is what is the threat sector? You know, where should regulation come from? How do we even review how it's been integrated or how it works? And I think as long as we go through the process calmly and even-headedly, then we'll get to a good outcome. But I think it's normal for us to be afraid of new frontiers. That's totally understandable. I think as long as we move towards it, you know, cautiously but optimistically, then I think we'll end up in a better place.
Oh, that sounds good. But I do want to follow up asking there. I mean, it seems pretty clear that there's no way around that it is going to affect a lot of people's jobs sure. In one way or the other. I think a positive example, though, have you seen the documentary series? I think it's called Light and Magic. It's about the kind of birth and growth of industrial light and magic. So there's a very interesting episode there where they capture when basically digital entered the industry, with Jurassic Park. If I remember right, it was really two people at ILM that created the original animation of the Tyrannosaurus Rex, and when everyone saw that, they instantly realized that, okay, this industry have changed forever.
Right.
And very quickly, a lot of people that were, I guess you would call them puppeteers, kind of moved, was going to lose their jobs. But the positive side of the story is that, now you have these digital models, but someone has to animate them, so it looks good. So a lot of these puppeteers, they started to work with this instead, because they were the one who knew how things should move. Mm-hmm. It's just that they had done that with puppets before, and now they were doing it with a digital tool. So sure. they kind of got a different tool instead, for their craft. So I think that's it might be that we're going to see, hopefully, I think we're going to see a lot of that, where some jobs are going to change quite drastically, but it doesn't necessarily mean that everyone's, losing their job.
Yeah. The people that sort of understand it earlier, right, and embrace it, I think will be the ones that are given the advantage in how it all plays out. But I do agree with you. I think there's different aspects and ingredients, but the more we approach it and gather knowledge around it, then the better you know, equipped we will be to go on the journey of the future.
I hope you liked that interview. If you did, you know what to do. Share it on your favorite social media so others can learn from the Favor community.